Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Glucksman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour, presented in collaboration with Irish Radio Network USA and Adrian Flanley. My name is Dr. Miriam Nyhan, and I will be your host on Saturdays from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can tune in to us on WNYE 91.5 FM and on HD in the Tri-State area, and worldwide on www.irishradio.com. So whether you're here in New York City, or in Ireland, or somewhere else further afield, sit back, relax, agus fáilteas teach. For those of you who don't already know, Glucksman Ireland House is NYU's Centre for Irish and Irish American Studies, inspired by the vision and philanthropy of Lewis L. Glucksman and Loretta Brennan Glucksman. Glucksman Ireland House, NYU, has evolved into a vibrant and world-renowned centre for the study of Ireland, Irish America, and the global Irish since its founding in 1993. We're coming to you today from our home, which is an elegant townhouse at Washington Mews and Fifth Avenue in New York City's Greenwich Village. Well, folks, another week over. For any of you watching the election results in Ireland, we had a general election yesterday. I know people will be keeping an eye on results to see who is returned, if we're going to have the government that was in place returned, or if we're going to have a change in regime. So it's been a lot of politics this week in terms of Irish media. There's a lot of that stuff going on here in this side of the Atlantic as well, with the presidential debates and things like that. Now, explicitly Irish things were not primarily on our radar this week because we held our annual gala and we were pretty busy with that. It was a great event on Tuesday night here on campus at the Kimmel Center. We welcomed all the great and good of Irish New York to celebrate our honorees, Danny MacDonald and Colm McCann, two great Irish New Yorkers who've done so much in their own spheres to touch the lives of others. Danny has been and continues to be a pioneer in the field of hospitality. He owns numerous high-profile, or he's a co-owner and designer of many high-profile drinking establishments and eating establishments here in the city. Some of them you might know, like Ulysses, Swift, the Dead Rabbit, and most recently Pier A, among others. Great guy, very humble guy, and it was wonderful to celebrate him. And of course our old friend and good friend, Colm McCann, who has been a part of the community of Glucksman Ireland House, I think almost since its inception. It was great just to celebrate both he and Danny. They gave great speeches. It was a fun night. If you're ever interested in coming along, do go to our website and find out more about this annual event. We always hold it the last Tuesday in February. It's a great night out, and it's a great moment to celebrate and reflect on the legacy that has been given to us through the generosity and the pioneering vision. I say it every week on the program, folks. I talk every week. I'm very clear in the introduction to my program in alerting people to what Loretta and Lou Glucksman have done for the Irish community and for the New York community more generally. But this week it has special meaning in the aftermath of our gala, where we really do truly celebrate that legacy in a very, very explicit way. So, on this week's show, I have a few things going on. Anne Enright did a wonderful reading from one of her most recent novels a week from last Thursday. It was presented under the Great Organizational Skills and Hosting Skills of NYU's Creative Writing Center, so I'm delighted to share with you the audio of that. And then I'm going to go to an interview with Joan Freeman of Pieta House. Very important topic, and a wonderful woman, a very inspiring woman. So it's a bit of a mix this week. You never know what you're going to get on this radio hour. So sit back and relax, folks.
I'd like to thank you all for coming out tonight. I'm going to read from, the book. I'll just start with that bit where Dan says he's going to become a priest. It's 1980 in West Clare. We have some people from West Clare here in the audience tonight, where my father grew up. Not exactly where my father grew up in this book, but that's the landscape I drew on. And I was trying to remember 1980. It was the year the Pope came. The Pope. Everyone was a Catholic for 2 minutes. And it seemed, I mean, intensely a Catholic. And it seemed to me that it was a kind of the last hurrah of the Catholic Church in Ireland before its slow and interesting decline ever since. And that everybody was sort of super Catholic because of sort of with some intimation of what was coming after. Anyway, they don't know what's coming after here in this chapter, and I'll just give you a blast of it. This is Arthur Dan. He went up to college in Galway. He came back with notions, not the usual kind of notions, but notions of the priesthood. After this, Dan went back to Galway, and nothing happened until the Easter break, which is when he said he wanted to be a priest. He made the big announcement at Sunday dinner, which the Madigans always did with a tablecloth and proper napkins, no matter what. On that Sunday, which was Palm Sunday, they had bacon and cabbage with white sauce and carrots, green, white and orange, like the Irish flag. There was a little glass of parsley sitting on the tablecloth, and the shadow of the water trembled in the sunshine. Their father folded his large hands and said grace, after which there was silence. Apart from the general sound of chewing, that is, and their father clearing his throat, which he tended to do every minute or so. The parents sat at either end of the table, the children along the sides, girls facing the window, boys facing the room, Constance and Hannah, Emmett and Dan. There was a fire in the grate, and the sun also shone now and then, so they were warm as winter and warm as summer for 5 minutes at a time. They were twice as warm. Dan said, I have been speaking again with Father Fall. It was April, a dappled kind of day. The clean light caught the drops on the windowpane in all their multiplicity, while outside 1,000 baby leaves unfurled against branches black with rain. Inside, their mother had a tissue trapped in the palm of her hand. She lifted it against her forehead. Oh no, she said, turning away, and her mouth sagged open so you could see the carrots. He says, I must ask you to think again. That it is hard for a man who does not have his family behind him. It's a big decision I am making, and he says I must ask you, I must plead with you not to spoil it with your own feelings and concerns. Dan spoke as though they were in private, or he spoke as though they were in a great hall, but it was a family meal, which was not the same as either of these things. You could see their mother had an impulse to rise from the table, but could not allow herself to flee. He said, I am to ask your forgiveness for the life you had hoped for me and for the grandchildren you will not have. Emmett snorted into his dinner. Dan pressed his hands onto the tabletop before swiping at his little brother fast and hard. Their mother blanked for the blow, like a horse jumping a ditch. But Emma ducked, and after a long second, she landed on the other side. She put her head down as though to gather speed. A moan came out of her, small and unformed. The sound of it seemed to please as well as surprise her, so she tried again. This next moan started soft and went long, and there was a kind of speaking to its last rise and fall. Oh, God, she said. She threw her head back and blinked at the ceiling once, twice. Oh, dear God. The tears started to run, one on top of the last, down to her hairline. 1, 2, 3, 4. She stayed like that for a moment while the children watched and pretended not to be watching. And her husband cleared his throat into the silence. Their mother lifted her hands and shook them free of her sleeves. She wiped her wet temples at the heels of the hands and used her delicate, crooked fingers to fix the back of her hair, which she always wore in a chignon. Then she sat up again and looked very carefully at nothing. She picked up a fork and stuck it into a piece of bacon as she brought it to her mouth, but the touch of the meat to her tongue undid her. The fork swung back down towards her plate and the bacon fell. Her lips made that wailing shape, touching at the middle and open at the sides, what Dan called her wide mouth frog look. Then she took a sharp inhale and went, it seemed to Hannah her mother might stop eating. Or if she was that hungry, she might take her plate and go into another room in order to cry. But this did not occur to her mother clearly, and she sat there eating and crying at the same time. Much crying, little eating. There was more work with the tissue, which was now in shreds. It was awful. The pain was awful. Her mother juddering and sputtering with the carrots falling from her mouth in little lumps and piles. Constance, who was the eldest, bossed them all quietly about, and they carried plates and cups past their mother as she dripped one way or another into her own food. "Oh, Mammy," said Constance, leaning in with her arm about her to slip the plate neatly away. Dan was the eldest boy, so it was his job to cut the apple tart, which he stood to do, dark against the window light, with the silver triangle of the cake slice in his hand. "You can count me out," said their father, who had been playing in a tiny way with the handle of his teacup. He got up and left the room, and Dan said, "Five, so how am I going to do five?" There were six Madigans. Five was a whole new angle as he moved the cake slice through the ghost of a cross and then swung it 18 degrees to the side. It was a prizing open of the relations between them. It was a different story altogether, as though there might be any number of Madigans and, out in the wide world, any number of apple tarts. Their mother's crying turned to funny staggered inhalations as she dug into her dessert with a small spoon, and the children too were comforted by the woody sweetness of the old apples. Still, there was no ice cream on offer that Sunday, and none of them asked for it, though they all knew there was some. It was jammed into the icebox at the top right-hand corner of the fridge. So that's 1980. I hope everyone remembers where the ice cream was in 1980. The children go and do their things, as Darren mentioned. I'm going to do two more short pieces. One is in 2005 when the children are back for Christmas. They've gone everywhere. And Rosaline, we see her next, and she's writing her. Rosaline is the mother. She's writing her Christmas cards and, you know, they've all left her, and she decides that just to show them, she's going to sell the house. So they all have to come back. I mean, she's right, they have all left her. So nothing. Actually, Constance has stayed, but Constance doesn't matter. The way the person who stays often doesn't matter. I mean, I know, I've met women like this. I mean, they look at you and say, "Where's the other one?" "Oh, I'm left alone." Anyway, this is Constance. As you see her in the first section, she's the eldest girl. She's the one who's doing the dishes. And it's a great belief of mine that if you start doing the dishes, you will never stop doing the dishes. And that is, in fact, what has happened to Constance. She is still doing the dishes and looking after her mother and getting everything ready for the reunion at Christmas in 2005. So I'm going to skip over the first section of the book, which is quite thoroughly and I hope kind of radically about each of their lives as they turn into adults and before they come home, bring their adult selves to meet their inner mother and find Rosaline instead. Anyway, Constance is doing the Christmas shop. This, if my students who are here, I wouldn't let this through, okay, if you wrote this. Thomason's is literally all over the shop, all right? You would have to walk the aisles in the supermarket. She bips about the place, so you'll have to forgive me, okay. The next morning, she went in early into Ennis. It was 10 a.m. on Christmas Eve, and the supermarket was like the apocalypse. People grabbing without looking and things falling in the aisles. But there was no good time to do this. You just have to get through it. Constance pushed her trolley to the vegetable section. Celery, carrots, parsnips for Desi, who liked them. Sage for the stuffing, an experimental bag of chestnuts, vacuum packed. Constance bought a case of Prosecco on special offer to wrap and leave on various doorsteps and threw in 8 frozen pizzas in case the kids rolled up with friends. Frozen berries, different ice cream. She got wine, sherry, whiskey, fresh nuts, salted nuts, crisps, bags and bags of apples, 2 mangoes, a melon, dark cherries for the fruit salad, root ginger, fresh mint, a wooden crate of satsumas, the fruit cold and promising sweet, each one with its own sprig of green, dark leaves. She got wrapping paper, red paper napkins, sellotape, and more out of habit now the children were grown, packs and packs of batteries, AAA, AA, a few C's. She took 5 squat candles in cream-coloured beeswax to fill the cracked hearth in the good room at Ardeven, where no fire was lit this 10 years past, and 2 long rows of simple red baubles to fill the gaps on her mother's tree. She went back for more sausages then because she'd forgotten about breakfast. Tomatoes, bacon, eggs. She went back to the dairy section for more cheese, back to the fruit aisle for seedless grapes, back to the biscuit aisle for water biscuits. She searched high and low for string to keep the cloth on the pudding, stopped at the delicatessen counter for pesto, chicken liver pate, tubs of olives. She got some ready-cooked drumsticks just to keep everyone going. At every corner she met a neighbour, an old friend. They rolled their eyes and threw Christmas greetings, and no one thought her rude for not stopping to converse. She smiled at a baby in the queue for the till. "I know," she said. "Yes, I know." The baby considered her fully. The baby gave her a look that was complete. "Yes," she said again, and got the curl of a sweet, thoughtful smile. All this kept Constance occupied until the time came to unload the contents of her trolley onto the conveyor. The baby held itself so proudly erect. The young mother underneath it looked like a prop. She looked like some kind of clapped-out baby stand. "You're doing great," Constance told her. "You're doing a great job." The bill came to €410, a new record. She thought she should keep the receipt for posterity. Desi would be almost proud. Constance pushed her trolley onto the walkway and the wheels locked cleverly onto the metal beneath them. And she was happy, happy, happy as she sank towards the car park. She thanked God from the burning, rising depth of herself for this unexpected life. A man who loved her. 2 sons taller than their father, and a daughter who kissed her still and there was no one there to see. She couldn't believe this was the way things had turned out. Her feet were swollen already. She could feel them throb, hot in the wrong shoes. Constance bumped the trolley off the walkway, set her trotters pumping across the concrete of the car park. It was 11:30 on Christmas Eve. In the pocket of her coat, her phone started to ring, and by the telepathy of the timing, Constance knew it was her mother. "What is it, darling?" she said, remembering as she did so that she'd forgotten the Brussels sprouts. "He's still asleep," said Rosaline. For a moment, Constance thought she was talking about her father, a man who was not asleep but dead. "Well, don't wake him," she said. "Dan, of course," she meant Dan, who was jet-lagged. "Should I? Or maybe, yes, yeah, get him straightened out." There was a pause from Rosaline. "Straightened out? You think? Have you got everything?" said Constance. "I don't know," said her mother. "Don't worry, it's a lot of work," said Rosaline. with a real despair in her voice. You'd think she had just spent an hour and a half in the insanity of the supermarket and not Constance. But I suppose it's worth it to have you all here. I suppose. Very sorry to see it go. She was talking about the house again. Any time she felt needy now or lost or uncertain, she talked about the house. Right, said Constance. Listen, Mummy. Mammy, said Rosaline. Listen. Oh, don't bother, I'll let you go. And she was gone. It was Rosaline, of course, who wanted Brussels sprouts. Nobody else ate them. Constance stood for a moment blank behind the crammed boot of the Lexus. You can't have Christmas without Brussels sprouts. Sometimes even Rosaline left them on the side of her plate, something to do with cruciferous vegetables or nightshades, because even vegetables were a poison to her when the wind was from the northeast. Oh, what the hell, said Constance. She slammed the boot shut and turned her sore feet back to the walkway and to the horrors of the vegetable section. Then over to the spices to get nutmeg, which is the way Rosaline liked her Brussels, with unsalted butter. And it was a good thing she went back up, because she'd no cranberry sauce either. Unbelievably. No brandy for the brandy butter, no honey to glaze the ham. It was as though she'd thrown the entire shop into her trolley and bought nothing. She had no big foil for the turkey. Constance grabbed some potato salad, coleslaw, smoked salmon, mayonnaise, more tomatoes, litre bottles of fizzy drinks for the kids, kitchen roll, cling film, extra toilet paper, extra bin bags. She didn't even look at the bill after another 15 minutes in the queue behind some woman who had forgotten flowers, as she announced, and abandoned her groceries to get them, after which Constance did exactly the same thing, fetching two bouquets of strong pink lilies because they had no white left. She was on the way home before she remembered potatoes. Thought about pulling over to the side of the road and digging some out of a field. Imagined herself with her hands in the earth, scrabbling around for a few withered spuds, lifting her head to howl. Back in Okavana, she unpacked and sorted the stuff that would go over to Ardivan for the Christmas dinner, and she repacked that. Then she went to Rory's room, where the child was sleeping off a hangover. Constance took off her shoes and climbed onto the bed behind him. Oh, he said. Your own fault, said his mother, as she spooned into him with the duvet between them and the wall at her back. Ah, ma, he said, and flapped a big hand over his shoulder to find a bit of her, which happened to be the top of her head. But Rory was always easy to hold, easy to carry, and easy to kiss. And there, in the smell of last night's beer and of his rude good health, fretful, lumpy Constance McGrath fell asleep. That's Christmas. I did a lot of research. I read the next bit in Galway, before the book was out, and I realised I should have read the New York bit in Galway and the West of Ireland bit in New York, that this would be the way forward. There's so much about books that is about elsewhere, about reading. Anyway, this is, nothing happens in my books. Rosaline goes for a walk, right? They have their Christmas dinner, nothing really happens, not much. Rosaline goes for a walk. This and that happens. But I do understand when readers say nothing happens in that book. I mean, apart from everything that happens. Extra cling film, extra toilet rolls, batteries. Anyway, I started this book some years ago. As a family, we took a rent in a small house in the west of Ireland, which is in the Burren in County Clare, overlooking the Flaggy Shore, which is an iconic landscape, one of the most beautiful places in the world. I mean, North America is full of beautiful places, but they're never as named and known and written about as the west coast of Ireland, which is famously, everywhere is both beautiful and famously beautiful. And this is part of the landscape of the Irish National Revival, and it was with some trepidation that I wrote is into this book. But there I was, going up myself every day onto the Green Road, which is just an unpaved road that goes over the top of the Burren, looking down on Sonor Beach and all the way up to Ballyvaughan, for people who know that area. And I thought, well, you know, this place is also real. It's not hugely real in the next section, where the landscape yields its story. Anyway, Rosaline is so cross that she goes for her walk after the Christmas dinner. That's what she does. Okay. And here she is having her walk. The air was cold and she was cold, so Rosaline thought hot thoughts, driving up over her own lawn, yes, and out the gate. She was so cross the car drove itself. They went for miles down familiar roads until they found her own stand of dark pine. She married a man who had a farm out on this road. They bumped past the house where Pat Madigan was born, the little door painted in flaking layers of green over red over blue. They drove right past all this, Rosaline and her little car, to another stand of trees that were her trees, horrible and dark. On and on they went until they came to the edge of things. Then the car stopped and Rosaline got out. The sea was huge for her. The light gentle and great, the fields indifferent as she walked up the last of the hill. But she got a slightly sarcastic feel off the ditches. There was no other word for it. Sprinkles of derision, like the countryside was laughing at her. Presences. At the gate beyond the last house where the tarmac road turned into the green road and the sheepdog turned for home, she looked back on the valley of Uddara, solemn and dark now with the flaggy shore at the sea edge of it, graves and dolmens there and ancient roads and gateways to nothing, from nothing. A couple of houses were lit up for Christmas, the blink of the lights a glimmering from this distance. There was a little ruined... distraction there. Solemn and dark now, okay. A couple of houses were lit up for Christmas, the blink of the lights a glimmering from this distance. There's a little ruined church down in that place, with a curse in the name of the man who built it, too terrible to speak aloud. This she knew from Pat Madigan, who took her walking along these uplands with her little dog in the summer of 1956. He talked more in those days and weeks than he ever did after, about curses and the like, pishogues, the fairies on the mound of Crookathy Hawn and the people lost in the scrubby, treacherous ground below it. He talked about the foxes behind Knockawn's Mountain, the 17 ancient forts between here and Slieve Elva, and the goats that lived in the hazel scrub. He told her of the depth and beauty of the cave called Powell na Gcrí, the two Englishmen who went down it with ropes and lamps. He pointed to the place where the three townlands met, Uddara, Ballinhown, and Crumlin, a gap in the cliff that belonged to none of them, called Laba na Héan Bho, the bed of the one cow. There was a story, he said, about that cow and the end of the world. Then he laughed and told her about a heifer he had once who came into heat with her head stuck in a big bucket, a tub almost, made out of blue metal. The handle was up over her paw, whatever way she managed it, and the bull was working her, the pair of them walking the field with the bucket swinging and banging until she came into a standing heat, and he mounted her. And the sound out of her then, he said, I'm surprised she didn't deafen herself in the bucket. There was no stopping him. He pointed to a house where a man killed himself by hanging and a rock overlooking the sea where the ghost of a hungry man was said to sit, turning to stare at passers-by. He talked of a place that was miles away where a woman kept her daughter chained in the hen house and a woman whose house was full of money. sent by her sons in America. He said there were babies born in one house that never saw the light of day. He said that the women of one family in particular took their babies back into themselves, like cats did their kittens. And it was important always to marry out in a place like this if you got the chance. And she was his chance. He did not say that he loved her. He said that if she would have him, a fine woman like her, unencumbered and free with her own money and no one to stop her, if she would make her choice and choose him, that he would worship her with his body and with his entire soul until the day he died. Foolish but true. That is what he said. And that is the way he saw the land, with no difference between the different kinds of yesterday, no difference between a man and his ghost, between a real heifer and a cow that was waiting for the end of the world. It was all just a way of talking. It was the rise and fall in the telling, a rounding out before the finish, a flourish, a shiver. And it was for her. He had saved every detail up for her alone, as though every rock and tree awaited her coming for its explication. And when she laughed at him, he only agreed with her. If I'm a fool, he said, then let me be a great fool and not a small one. There was no turning him down. And when he entered her, that first time, and every time subsequent, it was a sacred kind of pleasure he took. She was sure of it. My own Rosaline. Pat Madigan worshipped her. And he did not tell a lie. He wanted her for the money she had, for the fine house and the children he could get out of her. He laughed at her talk, and then he ignored her talk. But there were times, even in his last days, even at the very end, when he looked at her with a pride so keen, it was sinful. My virgin flower, my flower of flowers. Somewhere along here, that is where the first kiss happened between them, her little dog sitting down for them to finish, looking out to sea. She had married beneath her. Even the dog seemed to indicate it by the indifferent set of her head. My life of life, my saint of saints, my dark Rosaline. And ha, she said, because she'd had the pleasure of Pat Madigan for 40 years. And ha, because he was dead and she was still alive up here on the green road. Years since she had been kissed on the mouth. Years.
I'm delighted to welcome to the Luxman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour Joan Freeman, who's here with us by way of Pieta House in Ireland and more recently offering the service of Pieta House here in New York, and we're delighted to have the opportunity to have a chat about historically the great work that you and Pieta House have done, and I suppose let people know as well that the service is available in New York. This is your first time on our radio hour. Yeah. I know that you've been on with Adrian in the past, but we're delighted to welcome you to our programme. So would you mind, Joan, telling us, for the benefit of our listeners who aren't familiar, you know, as someone who's from Ireland and keeps connected with things in Ireland, I know about Pieta House, but some of our listeners may not. And can you tell us a little bit about the evolution of Pieta House in Ireland, and then maybe we'll talk about the New York setting.
Yeah. So, as you said, I'm from Dublin, I'm from Ireland, and I'm also a psychologist. And I had, 12 years ago, I had my own little practice in Dublin, and it was very handy because I could work the hours I wanted to work. I had four children, So when my kids were at school, I'd do a few hours. When they're in bed, I would do a few hours. But it also meant I could pick and choose the people I wanted to help. And if anybody came to me who was suicidal or self-harming, I'm so ashamed to admit it, but I would send them off very quickly to their local doctor or to the emergency room, very relieved that I didn't have to have them on my patch. Because as far as I was concerned, someone who was suicidal or self-harming was either mad, or not only were they, did I feel that they were a danger to themselves, but possibly to me. And not only do I look back with great shame on during that time, but I suppose I was a product of Kattegat as well, because, you know, we would have viewed suicide as a sin. I mean, even the word, when people say commit suicide, it conjures up the word sin or a crime. Mm-hmm. So when my own sister took her life, she was 52, and she had four children, you can imagine my whole idea of suicide and the understanding of suicide was shattered. Mm-hmm. So basically, I closed down my own practice and I started to research suicide, what would make someone take their life. And when I think back, I mean, Pieta's 10 years old now, so we're talking about 12, 13 years ago. Believe it or not, I had no internet in the house. So, and that's so hard to be when we think of mobile phones and everything. But every day I would book an hour in the local library on their internet, on their computer, and I would type in the word suicide, hoping that some explanation would come up for me. And that really, that I would discover that nobody could save anybody's life, that my sister's life couldn't have been, her death couldn't have been prevented. And basically the opposite came up. Most suicides can be prevented. And in the case of my sister, which is really reflects what happens with many suicides, is that she was reacting to a life event. And this was even more confirmed for me when Ireland went through that recession a few years ago. As soon as the recession hit Ireland, the suicide rates went up with farmers and people in construction industry who were worst affected. Mm-hmm. So that took me on a journey of further research. What, you know, where would I, if my sister was alive, where would I like to bring her? What sort of help would she need? And then the concept of Pieta House came up. And really, it is the alternative to the emergency room. But this is, our role is to prevent people from going to hospital. It is to carry them through their crisis, and crisis can be short-lived. And to stop viewing people as having serious mental health issues, when in fact, all that's happening is that they're reacting to a particular life event in their life.
So, so it would be fair enough to say, Joan, that up to that period of 10, 12 years ago, there really was very little in terms of support services for people who ended up in your sister's situation outside of an emergency room.
There was the emergency rooms or a psychiatric hospital. Mm-hmm. There was nothing else. And people, it wasn't just me, even though I beat myself up now, but most people in my position, in clinical position, would have felt the same way, that this was a medical problem, that it wasn't, you know, a social problem, mm-hmm. that it wasn't a problem of emotional distress, it was a medical problem. Ireland is now a very different country. We view suicide so differently. Now the first call of action would be to send someone to Pieta House. And when you think about how people would have suffered sitting in emergency rooms for hours and hours at a time, and most of the time then would leave before they were seen to. So everything has changed. People's whole concept of suicide has changed, and people are no longer afraid to look for help.
As you're talking, I'm a historian, Joan, by profession, and as you're talking, you know, part of me thinks, and I love your insights, because I'm sure you probably at least have some reflections or have thought about it. It's there's probably, you've pointed to like higher rates of suicide in terms of times of economic crisis and things like that. But do you think that generally, you know, suicide is more common now than it was in the past, or is it just more, you know, acceptable is a hard term because it's awful for the family and people involved in suicide naturally. But, you know, in the past in Ireland, it was a great shame, as you referenced. People weren't sometimes given Catholic burials or, and they were, you know, not buried in consecrated ground and all this stuff. But in terms of the historical stuff, has it really elevated in terms of a practice?
I suppose basically what you're asking is, have we normalised suicide?
I guess.
Yeah, and the answer is absolutely not. Suicide is not the normal reaction to a life crisis. When someone goes to take their life, it's because they see no other option. They actually don't want to die. They just want to stop this terrible pain. What has happened from a historical perspective is that years ago nobody spoke about it. Mm-hmm. It wasn't being documented. Because of that stigma, because they would be afraid that the person wouldn't be buried on hallowed ground. And if you think back, we can't think back, but if we talk again about historically, suicide was perfectly normal up until the 5th century. It was perfectly normal. In fact, I think there was a group of young men called the Dolomites, or something like that, the Dolo something. And they truly believed that if they took their life, they'd get to heaven far more quickly. And so it was the done thing to do. And it was, this is terrible. When you get to my age, you start forgetting names. But anyway, it became sort of a creed that this was not allowed to happen, that it became part of the church's ruling that you do not take your life, because what was happening was that all these young men were dying. And that quickly became enmeshed into criminal law as well. So if you attempt to take your life, not only was it against the church, but it was also against the land. And your belongings, whether you survived or not, would be taken off you. And this really originally was to prevent people from taking their life. They're trying to scare them out of taking their life. Now, this practice still goes on today, as we know, suicide bombers, again, who believe that they are going to getting a direct pathway to heaven if they do this, whatever, you know, for whatever reasons behind it. So that taboo and stigma has absolutely stuck to us ever since. I mean, even to this day, if someone dies by suicide, a family member will often say to me, "Do you think they've gone to heaven?" Because they're terrified that they haven't.
Mm-hmm.
So what's happening now compared to years ago, first of all, people are talking about it. People would come up to me and say that their brother died 40 years ago and they've never spoken about it to anybody. So we haven't normalised it. What we have done is we've given people permission to talk, permission to seek help, and that's the most important thing.
So tell me about where exactly Pieta House is and how, I imagine over the 10 years of its existence, even in Ireland, and it's wonderful to know that it's. I feel like there's probably a great need in the Irish-American community for something like this as well, and we'll get to that, but tell me a little bit about the Pieta House as it kind of evolved 10 years ago and maybe how it's changed or not in terms of that decade.
So 10 years ago we opened our first centre, which was in a little village in Lucan on the outskirts of Dublin, not knowing what we were going to face, not knowing whether people would come or not. And that first year we saw 70 people. So last year we would have seen over 6,000 people.
Wow.
We would have seen children as young as 6 years of age to people in their 80s. That one centre started off, as I said, in Dublin. We have now 9 in Ireland. A 10th one is opening up in the next couple of months. Our 11th one, or 10th one, was in New York a few months ago. It has become, of course, it's the service is free of charge. It's run by qualified psychotherapists or psychologists. It's not a drop-in. It's a therapeutic model that we created to help people in suicidal crisis. So this is a very a centre of excellence, a clinically proven method that works very, very well. So we started off with 2 part-time and 2 full-time staff. We now have 180 staff. And we've been asked by all over the world for advice. So I'm just back from Iceland, where suicide rates are 4 times that of Ireland, even though they've only got a population of 330,000 in their country. And while I offered to help them set up something for them that would be exclusively for them, they want the Pieta way. They see our organisation and our service as something that's proved to work exceptionally effectively. And I suppose the compassion is probably the cornerstone which attracts nearly every country. The fact that suicide before has been seen in a cold light, as I said, as a stigma and taboo. Now people are looking at that this should be handled with great respect and compassion.
So tell me then, Joan, when and how did it happen that there was felt to be a need for Pieta House to come to New York?
Well, it happened really by accident. We have an annual fundraiser, which is also an awareness campaign called Darkness into Light. And what that is, it's a 5K walk that starts at 4 o'clock in the morning and finishes just as the dawn is breaking, which is about an hour later. So our first one was about 9 years ago. Sorry, it was about 7 years ago. And we had it in the Phoenix Park, and 400 people turned up that morning, which, again, we were gobsmacked. Last year, 130,000 people walked across Ireland. So Ireland has just completely embraced everything about Pieta, about what it does and what it is trying to do. And we've become quite... We've got leadership qualities as far as suicide is concerned now, because so many other countries want to do the same thing. So I got a request asking could we have Darkness into Light in New York by the New York Irish Centre. Mm-hmm. A young woman called Rebecca Sked emailed me one day and she said, could we please have Darkness into Light here? And I said, of course. Started talking to them about it, and the next thing they started talking about, what about having a service over here? But, you know, specifically for the Irish. The Department of Foreign Affairs heard about it and asked us, would we do it? So they gave a grant of $90,000 to come over. So while we said, yes, we're looking at the Irish over here, it's important that we look at everybody, that we could never turn anybody away. So we had our first Darkness into Light in New York, and 1,000 people turned up last May. So this year we are in 5 venues in America. 2 places in New York, in San Diego, Chicago, Washington, and where else? And we got permission to walk across the Golden Gate Bridge.
Wonderful.
In San Francisco, so which is just great because that bridge is known as a bridge of tragedy. Mm-hmm. Where people from all over the world come over to take their lives. Mm-hmm. And now we're turning it into a bridge of hope.
Mm-hmm.
So again, the Irish, this is, I suppose I'm getting the biggest kick out of the fact that I'm Irish and that the Irish are bringing this to the world, and that's just such a wonderful thing to think about, you
mm-hmm.
know. So anyway, so one word borrowed another, and so we were asked could we open, so we opened just the end of September, and we're hoping to have another outreach place in New York so that we can cover as much of New York as possible.
Mm-hmm.
So we're in Long Island City, Jackson Avenue. So we're looking at another maybe very highly populated area in Woodlawn,
mm-hmm.
Which in fact this evening I'm going to see a site there, and we'll just see what happens then.
It strikes me, Joan, just in my own community at home in Wicklow, that you know, the Darkness into Light walks have been done there, and it's unfortunately it's the case that so many lives have been touched, either friends or relatives, by suicide, that it's really, you just came at a great moment in terms of harnessing that need for people to feel like they can reach out to others and maybe prevent it happening again in the future, right, and to raise awareness. Does Pieta House support both family? Is it only for the person in crisis, or does it extend beyond that?
So it certainly is for the person in crisis, but it's also for the family who has a person in crisis.
Okay.
Because what do you do?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what do you know what to do? And in fact, for the family, it's usually so much more difficult because you're helpless and you feel hopeless and you're living in fear and you're on permanent alert all the time. And the reality is, if we don't work with the family in collaboration, then this is not going to work at all.
Mm-hmm.
Because while the person will come to us, and if they need to every single day come to us while they're in crisis, that's for 1 hour. What happens to the other 23 hours? So the family is supported and guided and advised what to do in this situation. And that's why it works.
Joan, can I ask you, do you know how do Irish suicide rates, it's probably hard to compare just the sheer expanse of the population and the size, but do you have any sense of how are Irish suicide rates, say, comparable to those in the United States, or do you have any data on that?
Well, we came up, first of all, a couple of years ago. We did some analysis on our own attendance, people attending our services. And we discovered that 53% of people come to us were women, or were females. 47% were male. And we were clapping ourselves on the back because we thought, God, you know, men are rubbish at looking for help and all this sort of thing. And then when we sort of did a little bit of deeper analysis, we discovered, in fact, that it was the women who made the appointments for the men.
Mm.
So that was the first thing. The second thing we discovered was that there were two tipping points for men that would tip them over to consider taking their lives. One was anything to do with work. Hence, when the crisis hit us, men took their lives because either their business failed or they were made redundant, and their whole identity was shaken. And the second tipping point we discovered was the ending of a relationship. Men find it, as they get older, increasingly difficult if a relationship ends, because they need the emotional support from their partner. And we thought again how clever we were discovering all this, because we're listening to live people. This isn't post-mortem analysis. This is, you know, information we're getting the moment someone comes into us. Our first question to them is, why do you want to die? And our second question is, why do you want to live? So we were having real information. And when we looked at them, we discovered what was the tipping points of men. We saw that it was exactly the same across the world. So it is usually the same problems in America, across the world. The thing with the Irish over in America, there's more of a sense of isolation. At home, at least you have some support system, regardless of how small it is. Here, I'm from living here for 3 months, and New York is fabulous, but I've never felt so alone in all my life. And that's because of the vast numbers of people, and because they don't have those hubs of you know, that support system, even though the Irish are very good to each other over here. But that's all right when you're here for a few years. When you're here at the beginning, it's extremely lonely, and that wouldn't help if someone's over here, that sense of isolation.
Joan, I think I know the answer to this question, but I will finish up by asking you, I don't think you miss private practice, do you? You don't miss what
No.
you did before?
Absolutely not. I'd never be able to go back to it. And I suppose it was because of my sister. I could never sit in a room with someone and not be thinking of her.
Mm-hmm.
So I could never go back to that. But when I think of all the amazing people that I'm meeting, that I wouldn't have met if I was still in private practice, so I don't miss it at all.
But it strikes me that, you know, it was because of your professional background in, you know, colliding with this very personal event, right? I mean, if you did something else for a living, do you think you might have ended up doing this anyway or no? I mean, I know that's like a what if question, but it's like...
It's a very interesting question. And in fact, it's funny you should say that. I'm sure your listeners know of Mary Harney, who used to be the Minister for Health. So the first time I ever met her, and I just started Pieta House, her first question to me was, are you a psychologist? And if I had said no, if I had said I was a bookkeeper, I wouldn't have been taken seriously. And I think it's because of my clinical background that they did take me and the whole concept of Pieta House seriously. And when you think of all the hundreds of people across Ireland who have lost someone, who have tried to set up something, mm-hmm. like a mother who's lost a child, who might want to set up, you know, a helpline or something, if they don't have that clinical background, if they're not embraced mm-hmm. by someone who can support them in that, then Ireland is missing out on a very credible experience of a person who's lost someone through suicide and who knows some of the answers now.
So, I mean, you must, I mean, in a crude sense, I don't know whether you attempt to do that at all, Joan. You know, you must, like the Pieta House framework must have saved now thousands of lives.
It has. You know, to be perfectly honest, it has. And even in New York, it mightn't seem a huge amount just yet, but we haven't even pushed the service. We've seen 12 people in the last week who were quite critical, who couldn't, either didn't have health insurance or who wouldn't use that because of what it might mean on their record. So I know we're tapping into something that's really powerful here, but to be honest, you know, when you talk about a framework, none of this would be possible at all if people didn't have the courage to come to us in the first place. There'd be no service.
Well, listen, Joan, it's really wonderful to have this opportunity and indeed an honour to sit down and have an opportunity to talk to the person who was behind all this and in such desperately sad circumstances mm-hmm. that you've turned it around in such a lovely way and continue to be a great ambassador for us. Unfortunately, we wish in a way that this wasn't needed, right? Yeah. That we didn't yeah. need things like this. But to see, you know, and again, going back to me putting my historian's hat on, Joan, thinking about that legacy and history of the Irish in terms of going out into the world, and particularly thinking historically of the members of the religious orders who, you know, they get a lot of bad press these days for various reasons and things like that. But there has been this huge legacy and history of the Irish and social activism and help and caring for the others, which I think is probably deeply ingrained in the history of Christianity in the country, and for us not to throw the baby out with the bathwater as such, which yeah. you're exemplifying in such a beautiful way. We're coming towards the end of the programme. I'm Dr. Miriam Nyhan, and I want to thank you for listening to the Luxman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour, presented in collaboration with Irish Radio Network USA and Mr. Adrian Flanley. I'll be back again next Saturday, same time, on WNYE 91.5 FM in the tri-state area and on HD. In the meantime, if you'd like to get in touch with me or my co-producer Eli Elliott, we're on ireland.house@nyu.edu. And if you'd like to hear this program again, our website's at www.irishradio.com or to our archive at www.nyuirish.net/radiohour. Thanks for tuning in, folks. Have a lovely week. Slán agus beannacht. Our theme music this week is the opening set by The Gloaming, released by Brassland and Real World Records.